comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, the nonprofit agency providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Tomorrow morning in the first part of the show, we'll be talking about stormy weather, and we will have two guests from the University of Illinois. Donna Charlevoix, she's a lecturer in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences, and she is also the co-author of a book titled Severe and Hazardous Weather. The other guest, Glenn Romine, is member of the Convective Modeling Research Group in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the U of I. And we'll talk a little bit about particularly the kind of severe stormy weather we have at this time of year. That'll be hour number one. Hour two, our guest is Barbara Seaman, a women's health advocate, co-founder of the National Women's Health Network, and an advanced science writing fellow at Columbia University School of Journalism. And we'll be talking about some of the controversy over hormonal replacement therapy for women past menopause. She is the author of the book, The Greatest Experiment Ever Performed on Women, Exploding the Estrogen Myth. That will be in the second part of the program. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we will be looking back to a time in this country that some people have called the golden age of American bank robbery. And our guest for the program is Brian Burrow. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and is the author of a number of books, including Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of R.J.R. Nabisco. He's a former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and is now traveling around the country talking about a new book that he's got out now, a book which is entitled Public Enemies. The subtitle is America's Greatest Crime Wave and the Birth of the FBI, 1933-1934. And I'd just like to read you a couple of graphs from a little article, a piece that he wrote for the New York Times, because I think it does a really nice job of setting up the subject and also drawing some connections between that time and where we are now. And here's the way he wrote. This was back in May of this year. It's early in May. As cherry trees blossom along the Potomac, members of Congress are castigating the Federal Bureau of Investigation for its inability to rein in heavily armed attackers who've struck at the heart of America. Critics say the Bureau is incapable of discerning where the attackers may strike next, unwilling to work with rival agencies, and unfit to fight what appears to be a new kind of modern war. Some call for its wholesale reorganization. The embattled director of the Bureau pleads for more resources to combat the rising threat. This may sound like May 2004, but in fact, it was the crisis that gripped Washington 70 years ago. In May 1934, the armed attackers were not international terrorists, but homegrown kidnappers and bank robbers. John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, Babyface Nelson, Ma Barker, and Bonnie and Clyde. It wasn't the war on terrorism. It was the so-called war on crime. And for the FBI, it was going very badly. That is the story that Brian Burrow tells in the book Public Enemies, published by the Penguin Press. It's out there now. He is, as I mentioned, he's traveling around the country talking about the book. And in fact, he's in Chicago today and will be doing an appearance and a book signing at Barbara's Books in Oak Park on Lake Street tonight at 7:30. So if you're up there in the Chicago area, you can stop in and meet him. And of course, here on the program, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Well, Mr. Burrow, hello.
Hey, David. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
What were the conditions? Now, and I know in the book that you use this phrase, and I'm sure other people have used this phrase, about the golden age of American bank robbery. And note that the fact that really the point that we're talking about here, 33, 34, is at the tail end of that. But what was going on in America at the time that created the conditions to produce the golden age of American bank robbery?
Yeah, this period really dates from the mid-20s. And I think that the two most important developments were essentially technological. It was a question of a matter of technology outstripping the legal system. Primarily the new V8 engine, which really allowed bank robbers to get to quickly outdistance anybody else that wasn't driving a similar car, and the introduction of the Thompson submachine gun in 1920, which caught on with criminals far before it caught on with police departments, and would enable one bank robber to outgun all but the best armed urban police departments. So from the you had this period from the 20s on where bank robbers pretty much had their way and could do just about anything they wanted. It really was not until the FBI entered the fray in 1933 that they were able to put an end to it.
Yeah. You know, what's one of the things that to me is interesting is right in the front section of the book, you have some maps that show the activities of these various gangs, the Barker gang and Dillinger and Machine Gun Kelly and Bonnie and Clyde and Babyface Nelson. And when you look at the places where they committed crimes, where they were from, where they hid out, where they died, this crime wave was very much a Midwestern phenomenon.
Yeah, insurance companies back in the day had a word for the area from Texas up to Minnesota. They called it the Midwestern Crime Corridor. And I've always wondered exactly why that's so. Certainly, the drought hit the Midwest early in the mid-20s, and so a lot of people might have chosen to resort to crime. But I tell you, I think the biggest single factor, and you may laugh at this, in why the Midwest was the best place for robbing banks is it was a question of the roads. Any idiot with a bird gun can go in and rob a bank. The hardest part always is getting away, and to get away, you need long, flat, open roads without a lot of intersections. The few bank robbers who tried going east at various points, robbing banks in places like Maine and New Hampshire, they never lasted more than 6 months because it was just much harder to get away.
One of the other differences perhaps between that time and this is that at that time there was no federal law enforcement agency. The Bureau, in fact, the federal part wasn't even part of the name. I think originally it was just called the Bureau of Investigation. And as you point out, these guys, they didn't even have guns.
That's right. It was a good time to be a criminal in the 20s and the early 30s, because if you were able to get across a state line, there was really no one to chase after you, unless someone in Indiana called across and asked somebody to go after you, and that usually did not happen. It was only in 1932 that the FBI, which as you point out wasn't even the FBI, it was the BI, was given responsibility for handling a crime that anyone cared about, and that was interstate kidnapping. Up until 1933, FBI agents did not carry guns, they could not carry guns, and they had no powers of arrest. The FBI's responsibilities were kind of an odd grab bag of federal crimes, things like crime on Indian reservations and crimes at sea. And so this period was really the creation of the modern FBI.
Yeah. This must have been an extremely tough assignment at the time for J. Edgar Hoover when he was brought in, because there was obviously some people felt there was a serious crime problem and that it was a national problem and it needed to be addressed that way. And here we had this agency that was considered to be inept, that didn't really have the tools to do the job. He must have been in a very, very difficult situation.
He was, and I think there are a lot of stories that this book tells. Most of them I had a sense of going in, but the one that I feel like I stumbled upon that I discovered was this story of the development and transformation of the FBI. It is difficult to overstate the ineptitude of the FBI in the early months of this war on crime period, which was mid-1933 to the beginning of 1935, really just 20 short months that saw the rise and fall of all these criminal gangs that we're discussing. And basically, the FBI, young FBI agents, mostly between 25 and 35, very few of them with law enforcement experience, shoved out the door, given guns, and told to bring in the likes of John Dillinger. And the results, as you might expect, were fairly awful. They arrested the wrong people. In some cases, they convicted the wrong people. They shot the wrong people. Sometimes they killed the wrong people, and sometimes they got themselves killed.
What sort of background did Hoover have before he came into this job?
Hoover joined the Justice Department directly out of college in the late teens. He had been director of the Bureau since 1924, but it was by and large a Bureau that had very little to do, at least very little that would impact on the mindset of an average citizen. Most people, until the FBI came into conflict with John Dillinger and Babyface Nelson and Pretty Boy Floyd, very few Americans had ever heard of them. In fact, a lot of newspapers, the Chicago Tribune, the Milwaukee papers, I found where they ran sidebar articles explaining to people who the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover actually were.
Mm. The people that are the criminals, they're at the heart of the story, the people that we've mentioned, people like Dillinger and Machine Gun Kelly and Bonnie and Clyde. Probably today, the only reason these names have any resonance is because people because they have become figures in popular culture. The television has been made about people like them. Perhaps more importantly, movies have been made about them. The one big movie I'm sure a lot of people will remember was the movie about Bonnie and Clyde. There also was a movie not very long ago, I think, made about John Dillinger. So, you know, people have some sense just because they've seen stuff like that. What were these people really like? And was it was there anything that they really had in common, or was it just something about the times that fostered them and made it possible for these criminal groups to be so active and I guess you might say successful, at least until they were all killed?
No, they were successful for quite some time until the federal government got involved. You know, it's funny, you're right. I think most people do know the names of these people, Machine Gun Kelly, Babyface Nelson. But the central conceit behind the book was that I strongly doubt that most Americans understand that all six of these gangs were out there at the same time, that many of them knew each other. Some of them worked together. For instance, Dillinger and Babyface Nelson were partners. It's funny that you should mention Bonnie and Clyde, and it's terribly ironic that Bonnie and Clyde should be, I think, right now, by far the best known of the public enemies of the Depression, because they were by far the least significant at a time where the Ma Barker gang could bring in $200,000 from a single ransom kidnapping, that of a millionaire up in St. Paul, Minnesota. Bonnie and Clyde's biggest payday ever was one day they were able to rob a bank of $3,800. They actually spent more time robbing drugstores and filling stations than just about anything. And the movie, as great and wonderful a piece of cinema it is important when judging it to realize that it is essentially a figment of screenwriter's imagination. Mm-hmm. Bonnie and Clyde had almost no redeeming characteristics. Clyde was a serial murderer who killed upwards of 10 innocent men. Bonnie was a deluded housewife who didn't particularly care who Clyde killed. And, you know, they basically just drove from state to state robbing filling stations and shooting people until they were finally tracked down by a posse.
How did the media of the time portray these people? And did that make some contribution to creating some myth that came to surround them?
Yes. The media was important here, especially in the development and the evolution of John Dillinger's fame. Dillinger, it's important to understand, was by far the most famous of the public enemies. If you were to give a notoriety index to these people, let's say Pretty Boy Floyd and Babyface Nelson were a 3, Bonnie and Clyde were a 1, very few people had heard of them. Dillinger was a 9, and part of the reason of his appeal was his appeal to the everyman of America. People really loved Dillinger. It's difficult to overestimate his appeal to people. Part of it, of course, was the times, the fact that many Americans were prepared to cheer on just about anybody that was seen as striking back at the authority that people felt had robbed them of their livelihoods. People blamed the banks. They were angry. They blamed the government. And Dillinger had a real common touch. He seemed keenly aware of public relations and the value of having good public relations. And he was always doing little things like laying down coats for his female hostages to lay on. In the middle of robberies with alarm bells clanging, when policemen would respond and run up to the front door, Dillinger would meet him with a Tommy gun and say things like, "Come on in, boys, we're having a robbery." But the single biggest fact, I think, in Dillinger's fame was the fact that near the height of his notoriety in January of 1934, he was captured, brought back to Indiana, and an awful lot of reporters were allowed to go in and interview him and photograph him. And he did very well. He came across very well. But this is as opposed to almost all the other public enemies, Clyde Barrow, Machine Gun Kelly, Pretty Boy Floyd, who the public really only got to know when they were killed. So people had a sense of who Dillinger was, a sense that they knew him. And it was a sense that only grew once he escaped from jail. And, you know, at one point he escaped from the FBI five times in just 23 days. So there was a real kind of Wile E. Coyote roadrunner quality to the whole Dillinger story.
Is it actually true that someone asked him, why do you rob banks? And he said, because that's where the money is?
No, that was Willie Sutton,
robber
from the 50s. Dillinger's favorite famous line was given at a bank robbery in East Chicago in January 34, where a customer who had the bad luck to be standing in line when they walked in, a customer, you know, began to hand over his money to Dillinger, and Dillinger put his hand up and said, no, son, don't want your money, just the banks.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a pretty good line, too. I guess I'm getting my bank robbers all mixed up. Well, it's interesting, though, because that does you also wonder just what out there among the public, was there much sense of outrage about this, given the fact that we are talking about the Depression and the fact that a lot of people thought the banks were bad anyway, and that maybe that they had it coming.
Well, it's funny. You go back and you read the Indianapolis News or the Chicago papers or Milwaukee or the places where Dillinger was best known. His area was the upper Midwest. That's where he did almost all his work. And you go back and you look at the letters to the editor, and they are just hilarious because from the early weeks of Dillinger's career, and we're talking about a 14-month period here, people were writing letters to the newspapers saying, why are the police giving John Dillinger such a hard time? He's not doing anything that my neighborhood banker didn't do to me. Mm-hmm. He's not hurting anybody but the banks and the insurance companies. So there were a lot of people that cheered him on. In fact, theater owners at one point took a poll of other theater owners and found that Dillinger was the third most applauded figure in the newsreels of the day, behind only President Roosevelt and Charles Lindbergh.
Yeah. Well, I do. You did in the book. You quote a little bit of a couple of lines from a song by Woody Guthrie. That song where he talks about he's traveled around the country and seen lots of people, and some people rob with a six gun, and some people use a fountain pen.
Yeah.
Our guest is Brian Burrow. He is special correspondent for Vanity Fair magazine. He's the author of a number of books, including one we're talking about here this morning, which is titled Public Enemies. It looks at America, the great crime wave that swept America in the 30s, 1933-34, and how that really led to the birth and development of the modern FBI. The book is published by Penguin Press. Public Enemies is the title. He's in Chicago today. He's been traveling around talking about the book. So questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe I'll ask you to tell the story about an event that, for a lot of people, they consider it to be the thing that really started the war against crime, or was an event that was so shocking that the government had to respond. This took place in June of 1933, an event that came to be called the Kansas City Massacre.
Yes, the Kansas City Massacre was clearly the triggering event for this war on crime period. It was basically this. One of the few things that the FBI did was return escaped federal prisoners to federal prisons. And on that morning, Saturday morning, June 17, 1933, a group of FBI men escorted by some local cops from Kansas City was taking a bank robber named Frank Nash off a train up from Arkansas where he'd been captured, and they were going to take him up to Leavenworth. They marched him out to the parking lot where three unknown assassins suddenly opened up on them with Thompson submachine guns, killing five men, including an FBI agent. This caused J. Edgar Hoover to immediately say that they were going to, you know, do everything they could to bring in and find out who the shooters were. But in fact, that event quickly led to a much more significant overall federal war on crime. It's important to put this whole period, everything from the Kansas City Massacre to Dillinger, in an overall political context, and that is this. We've often heard of the Roosevelt administration's famous first 100 days, in which it passed many elements of important legislation that centralized federal control over many aspects of government and the economy. The Kansas City massacre happened on day 101, and it fit into this context, and that was the Roosevelt administration also wanted to centralize federal control over many areas of law enforcement. But to do that, they needed something to happen. And they used the Kansas City massacre essentially as a pretext to build up the FBI, to wheel the FBI out and basically say, okay, here's some guns, go chase these kidnappers and bank robbers. And the first two cases were the Kansas City massacre and the kidnapping, which happened just 48 hours before the massacre, of a very wealthy brewer named William Hamm up in St. Paul. And so it was the FBI's new war on crime became kind of a cutting edge of the New Deal. Essentially, if Hoover and his nascent FBI could bring in some of these public enemies, these new supervillains that the FBI began talking about, it would be real tangible evidence of the efficacy of the New Deal policies of the new administration.
We have a caller here, somebody with a question, and obviously others who are listening. If you're interested in calling in, getting involved in the conversation, asking questions, you can do that here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Crete to talk with here, first off, on line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, I just wondered if you have visited the John Dillinger Museum in Hammond, Indiana.
I did, and I found it to be a pretty darn good museum.
What do you think about a museum that has a dedication to the late great John Dillinger?
Well, I know that it's been controversial up in Lake County. I don't judge. I feel like evil is as well worth studying as is good. I think there's a thin line between studying a criminal and glamorizing the criminal, and I certainly have tried to stay on what I judge to be the correct side of that line. I like that museum. I really find that it's a professional presentation that does not unnecessarily glorify Dillinger.
A couple other questions. I teach a course on American crime, so I'm sort of involved with some of the stuff that you wrote about, and I'm looking forward to your book, especially when it comes out in paperback, so I can have my students buy it. Pretty Boy Floyd, was he at the KC massacre or wasn't he?
This became one of the great mysteries of this period. Was the FBI came out and announced that Pretty Boy Floyd was responsible for the Kansas City massacre. Most historians, as you probably know, have come to the conclusion that he wasn't. I come to the conclusion that almost certainly he was. I uncovered three separate statements from people who discussed the massacre after it happened with Floyd or with his partner that morning, another gangster named Vern Miller. All three statements agreed that essentially Miller and Floyd carried it out.
He had probably the greatest funeral of any gangster or criminal in American history when he died down there in Oklahoma. I mean, when he was buried in Oklahoma, they say
Floyd was kind of a regional folk hero, just as Dillinger was a national one. I mean, Floyd was a real hero, especially in Oklahoma, in eastern Oklahoma. But it's funny to notice how his notoriety was almost exclusively limited to that part of the country at the time. When he was first killed, if you look at the Washington Post, he was introduced to readers as, quote, a southwestern outlaw, clearly suggesting that he was not nearly as famous in the east as he was in Oklahoma.
It's interesting that you mentioned the word killed. Some would maintain, along with Bonnie and Clyde, who were shot in ambush, and John Dillinger, who was gunned down in front of the Biograph without raising his own gun, and now we talk about Pretty Boy Floyd, there's a group of historians and scholars who maintain that Pretty Boy was shot dead by Purvis after he had already been wounded and brought down by another marksman.
Yeah, that story has achieved a lot of currency, and while I agree with you that Bonnie and Clyde were killed with no warning in ambush, and Dillinger didn't get any significant warning before he was shot down outside the Biograph Theater.
That's for sure.
In Chicago. I don't buy the story based on all the evidence I've looked at that essentially Floyd was murdered. You know, he was running across a cornfield. He was clearly felled by two shots. What happened then essentially is he just died. But 50 years later, one of the policemen who was present came out with this story and told it in the Ohio newspapers that he had been executed as he lay down by an FBI agent. And I talked with a number of people who knew this gentleman that told the story, and they basically, none of the people locally who knew the man believed him. And I don't think that there's any credibility to that story.
And finally, the great question of all time regarding gangsters and outlaws, did Dillinger in the Crown Point jail fashion his own little pistola, or was that a real gun handed to him by one of the guards?
Well, you're referencing what is one of the great moments of American crime, and I spent a lot of time on it in the book, and that is Dillinger's escape from the jail in Crown Point, Indiana in the first week of March 1934. And the controversy there has always been there were claims at the time that Dillinger used a wooden pistol to escape, and a lot of people just didn't believe it. Some people said it was true. I tend to believe that it was true. In fact, that he did not fashion the pistol himself. Evidence suggests that his lawyer's investigator, a gentleman named Arthur O'Leary, paid a man to make it for him in downtown Chicago and handed it to Dillinger during a conference with his attorney, and that Dillinger, in fact, did use a wooden gun to take his first few hostages at the jail that day. In fact, according to the FBI records that I've studied that have now been released in the last 15 years, once Dillinger got most of the guards locked up in cells, he actually took the wooden gun out, tapped it on the cells, and said something to the effect of, "This is how tough your little jail is. I did it all with this."
And finally, the amazing feature, the FBI got into that case because Dillinger took a car from Indiana and drove it across the state line into Illinois, and that launched the FBI's investigation.
Well, now, I argue that I think that is the thinnest of fig leaves, that if Hoover had wanted to go after Dillinger before, he could have found a fig leaf at some point. The fact was, at that point, Dillinger, the hysteria over Dillinger's escape was so paramount. It was top of the front page news everywhere in the country, that if Hoover was to have any claim at all at being significant, at being the nation's first true federal police force, he needed, it kind of forced his hand. He needed to go after Dillinger, and I believe that they used that supposed Dyer Act violation, as it was a call, is basically a fig leaf to go out and make their bones.
I'm going to hang up, but would you just comment on the bungling police and FBI agents at places, say, for example, at Little Bohemia, where they really began to shoot people who really they shouldn't have shot? And
well,
thanks a lot for the book, and I look forward to reading it.
Well, thank you for your wonderful questions.
Thank you.
The highlighter, the narrative climax of both this book and the whole war on crime period was something called the Battle of Little Bohemia, which some people may remember. It was kind of the Waco or the Ruby Ridge of its day. Late on a Sunday night in April 1934, two dozen FBI agents surrounded John Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, three of their partners, and five of their girlfriends and wives at a lodge called Little Bohemia in remote northern Wisconsin. And when dawn broke the next morning, one FBI agent was killed, another was in the hospital. The FBI had killed a civilian, and Dillinger and Nelson had gotten away clean. And it was at that point that the FBI's ineptitude was really exposed to the nation. The FBI was really held up as a national laughingstock. And the FBI files now reveal for the first time what happened in the wake of that. It's kind of an interesting story. It became obviously very clear to Hoover that his men knew, of all their faults, perhaps the biggest was their ineptitude with guns and in gunfights. And so Hoover cast around the FBI's 25 or so domestic offices. They sent out a memo asking for supervisors to identify any and all agents who might be willing to handle work of a dangerous that would be dangerous, that would involve gunplay. And I think there were something like 448 agents, and supervisors were able to identify 11 that might who might be suitable for work of a dangerous character. So Hoover got desperate, and what he did was he began hiring skilled marksmen off the pistol shooting teams from the police departments in Oklahoma City, Dallas, Houston, Austin. I think they got one from Waco. And these two dozen or so sharpshooters were brought up to Chicago, and they formed the core of a new and improved Dillinger squad that, you know, within a year was able to extinguish all of the significant public enemies.
Yeah, and actually it wasn't, it seemed to me that, I hope I have these dates right, this was the Battle of Little Bohemia was in May of 34, that it was in July, so it was just a matter of a few weeks later that Dillinger was killed in Chicago.
Yes, exactly. Well, the two changes that were made, and they've really only been disclosed now, 70 years later, in the FBI's files. One was the bringing in of these sharpshooters. The other, and this is a little bit more controversial, was the FBI's wartime field general was the lead agent in Chicago, a fellow named Melvin Purvis, who is, I think, hands down the most famous FBI agent in history. Purvis has always been seen as a tragic character because after his success in bringing in Dillinger and bringing in Pretty Boy Floyd, he was ultimately harassed from the FBI by J. Edgar Hoover, having been Hoover's favorite agent for so many years. And two generations of historians have basically said this was because Hoover was jealous of Purvis, who became a national hero. In fact, I argue in the book that an analysis of FBI records show that while Mr. Purvis was a very earnest, very well-meaning young man, he was also a pretty awful FBI agent. And immediately after Little Bohemia, which he had supervised, he, in fact, was replaced as the FBI's wartime field general by a desk man sent out from Washington. Purvis was able to stay on the job as head in Chicago and supervise a number of agents, but a new supervisor was put above him, a fellow named Sam Cowley. And it was Cowley who really should, I think, reap a lot of the credit for then bringing in the Dillingers and Floyds. Mm.
As the caller mentioned, there have been times, and maybe even still now, that some people talk about the circumstances under which some of these people were killed. They actually use the term assassination. And so what exactly was the Bureau's policy? Was the idea primarily that they would like to take these people alive, or was there some sort of thing out there that said, you know, we don't care, dead or alive, or
no,
that we'd prefer that they'd be dead?
Because, you know, if you go back and look at these million pages of FBI records, you come to appreciate an awful lot the advancements we've had in civil rights over the last few years. There was not a lot of discussion in most cases whether someone would be shot or whether someone would be captured. There were discussions among the arresting parties, like among the five or six guys that went after Dillinger and that went after Bonnie and Clyde. And in both cases, they just came to the feeling that we got to shoot them; they're just too dangerous. But there was a lack of a top-down. There was no policy coming down from Washington on how to handle these things. The most fascinating case that I came upon involved a minor member of the Dillinger gang named Eddie Green. The FBI got a tip on where he would be one day in April 1934, and they went to stake out a house where he would be arriving at St. Paul, but they didn't have a great identification of him. They weren't entirely sure what he looked like. So one of the three FBI agents at the house called downtown and asked his supervisor, now what exactly should we do if this guy comes up to the door? And the orders were rather succinct. The orders, according to the FBI's own files, were, quote, shoot him. This somewhat bothered the agent at the house because he was concerned that perhaps they wouldn't be able to recognize Mr. Green. So he called down again, and the orders were repeated, just shoot him. So when Eddie Green came out to the house, they opened up with a Thompson gun through a window, and they killed him. This was the level of civil rights we were dealing with in 1933 and 1934. It was they didn't give nearly as much concern to things like Miranda warnings.
Let me introduce again our guest, Brian Burrow. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair. He's authored a number of books, including Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of R.J.R. Nabisco. He's former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and is the author of a newly published book titled Public Enemies, America's Greatest Crime Wave and the Birth of the FBI, 1933-34. And it is indeed about how the FBI tried to gear up to go after the kind of people that we've been talking about, including Machine Gun Kelly and John Dillinger. Danger and Babyface Nelson and the Barker Gang, folks of that ilk, people who were active during this time that some people refer to as the Golden Age of American Bank Robbery. The book, it's published by Penguin, the Penguin Press. The author is on tour now. He's in Chicago, and if you're in the area there and you're interested in meeting him, he'll be doing a signing at Barbara's Books in Oak Park on Lake Street tonight, 7:30 in the evening. And otherwise, if you just like to read the book, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. Number here in Champaign-Urbana for questions, 333-9455. And we do also have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Among the things that you talk about in the book, things that you discovered as a result of your research, one has to do with Ma Barker, another one of these characters that if people know anything about her, maybe they know about her from bad movies or from sort of tabloid pulp kind of writing. And here also is a case where it looks like to cover up a screw-up, the FBI
exactly
perpetrated,
right.
perpetrated a myth.
Well, Ma Barker was, after her death at the hands of the FBI, was really one of the great American figures throughout most of the 20th century. Hoover held her up as a criminal mastermind, the brains behind the famous Barker Gang. I think that, frankly, her notoriety has begun to dim over the last few years. There hadn't been a good movie on Ma Barker since, I think, 1969. But basically, I come out in the book and say not only was Ma Barker not the criminal mastermind of the Barker Gang, she wasn't even a criminal. She never robbed the bank. There's no evidence she even fired a gun. During most of 1933 and 1934, as best I can tell, she was holed up in an apartment in Chicago doing jigsaw puzzles. What happened was this. Her two sons, Fred and Doc Barker, ran, along with some other gentlemen, ran the Barker Gang. They were very successful kidnappers and bank robbers. She certainly knew of what they did. She lived luxuriously off their ill-gotten profits, and she traveled with them. But that's a long way from saying she was a criminal mastermind. Well, what happened was this. In January 1935, when two dozen FBI agents surrounded a lake house in rural Florida where she was hiding with her son, Fred, a gunfight opened up. Fred was killed. Ma was killed. And J. Edgar Hoover was forced to step in front of a Washington press conference and answer the question of why his men had just killed a 61-year-old grandmother that no one had ever heard of. At that point, rather than wait for the question, Hoover took the offensive and decided to announce that Ma Barker was the criminal brains of the game. David, there were actually some great quotes that Hoover gave that day. Things like, you know, she was so smart we never got anything on her. We had to kill her to catch up with her. These types of things. And as a result, you know, she became a legendary criminal. When in fact, my research candidly suggests she was nothing of the sort.
Yeah. Well, here's some other callers, folks with questions. We'll go to a caller in Indiana on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This isn't a criticism, but it's a question of definition, perhaps, or maybe it's just rhetoric. You mentioned it's a crime wave. I think we're sort of in a crime wave now with drugs, but I guess the publicity angle may be important, or just what is it that distinguishes somebody writing a book like yours versus somebody might writing a book about drug kingpins now, who certainly have killed more people and sure in hell made a lot more money.
Yeah, there is no way to define a crime wave, but clearly it's a question of perception as much as it is numbers. And we don't really have reliable numbers that talk about overall criminal statistics from 1933 and 1934, but there certainly was a widespread perception then that America was undergoing something that it had not undergone before. I think in terms of national and international seriousness, the wave of bank robberies and kidnappings that we had in 33 and 34, well, certainly sensational. In terms of overall significance, pale before what drugs have done to the country over the last few years.
Mm. I think you, in using that phrase, you're probably more reflecting the way that people in 1933 and 1934 were talking. They talked about it as being a crime wave.
They certainly felt like it was a crime wave.
All right. Well, let's go to Chicago next, line 1.
Hello? Yeah, hi.
Yes.
I tuned in late, so you may have touched on this, but I wonder what sorts of families these guys came from. The reason I ask is that years ago, I guess the late 40s or early 50s, Life magazine had a huge spread on a guy who apparently was the one of the main exterminators from Murder Incorporated, and he was spending a life term in New York State. I'm originally from New Jersey, and the brother and sister-in-law of this guy were neighbors, and these were the nicest people you would want to meet.
Yeah, there really seems to be no consistent viewpoint on the backgrounds of at least the seven or eight public enemies that I'm writing about. John Dillinger and Machine Gun Kelly came from what you'd have to say were upper middle class backgrounds. Dillinger's dad owned, you know, four or five different real estate, you know, income houses. Machine Gun Kelly actually made a stab at a semester of college. On the other hand, you have people like Clyde Barrow, who basically grew up in extreme poverty. His family actually lived underneath a viaduct in Dallas for a period during the 20s. So, you know, it's difficult to point to conditions that created any of these people in terms sociologically. I mean, basically, if you want to get down to it, what created most of these people is very few of them wanted to work for a living. They were looking for shortcuts.
Uh-huh.
There are some real parallels there about just almost all these guys by their early 20s were laying around pool halls and trying to do everything they could to avoid serious work.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let us continue. We have another caller here, and that caller would be in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, you mentioned international aspects, the caller before last, and I was just curious if anybody else perceived a large increase in crime in different countries, like maybe Canada, Great Britain, Mexico, that kind of thing, in the same period. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
No, not at the time. This was seen as a distinctly American phenomenon, but one, in fact, you're right, that newspapers around the world commented on. I mean, the Nazi newspapers in Germany got in on this and were saying, what did this say about America, that you know, their criminals are out of control and they can't keep public order? And then on the other hand, when the FBI did shoot down Dillinger without any warning, the Nazi newspapers came out and said, this proves American barbarism that they would do this. Dillinger especially, more than any of the others, was an international phenomenon. He was front page news in London, in Paris, and all over the world.
Well, again, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We have about 10 minutes left. If other folks want to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked about some of the spectacular crimes, the Kansas City Massacre. We talked about what happened at Little Bohemia. And we associate these figures with armed robbery, bank robbery, and so forth. Two, though, in a couple of cases, two probably of the most important sort of crimes, I think you argue in the book, were not bank robberies. They were not robberies at all. They were kidnappings.
Yes, the Lindbergh kidnapping in 1932 really was widely, you know, it took about 12 to 18 months, but people began to widely copy it. And part of it had to do with the fact that it looked easier than bank robberies. But the other thing was interesting that's not commented on a lot is that there were so many fewer banks. Banks were shutting down left and right during 1932 and 1933, and those that were left, especially in the Midwest, were becoming little arsenals because they were getting robbed so much. So the Barker gang, for instance, resorted to kidnapping after they essentially got tired of being shot at. They had a man killed at a robbery in Nebraska in April 34, and they went back to St. Paul, which was their base at the time, and put together a kidnapping for the following month. They got $100,000 at it. They decided they liked it, and they did another one the following year, and they got $200,000. It was sometimes tough. You had to be smart, and I think the Barkers were probably the cleverest of these criminals, because Machine Gun Kelly, his luck was not nearly so good. He kidnapped a gentleman in South Bend, Indiana, and the family was not nearly as rich as he speculated they were. And the family, when the family was unable to come up with a ransom, Kelly was obliged to release his captive only on basically receiving an IOU from the family. The family said, "Yeah, we'll get you that ransom as soon as we can. Thanks."
Hmm. Somebody, this is an interesting question. I guess it goes back again to the family issue. A listener was just wondering, did any of these, the infamous people that we're talking about, the public enemies, did any of them have children?
Yes. In fact, Machine Gun Kelly and Pretty Boy Floyd gave birth to sons who are still alive today, gentlemen in their 80s, I believe, that is still will occasionally give interviews. Alvin Karpis had a son who just died last year on the south side of Chicago. None of their progeny achieved anything like the fame of their parents.
Or infamy.
Yes. Clyde Barrow's sister, just last remaining sister, just died last year. And it's amazing how, in talking about this period, David, it sounds like we're talking about the Wild West.
Mm-hmm,
there are still people alive that were in banks when Bonnie and Clyde robbed them. Babyface Nelson's widow just died in 1987.
Yeah, in the book, there's an interesting passage where you talk a little bit about how in some respects we think of this time as being very different from ours, and yet in others it's really not, and we're certainly talking about a time that's not all that long ago.
Well, that surprised me. I when you watch movies about this, for instance, and the movies are generally pretty bad, there is an otherworldly sense. Yet when you go back and study 1933, it's not all that different from today. We have the same influential national publications, Time and Newsweek. Radio is where a lot of people got their news. The greatest difference essentially was television, no television.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else here. Caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I had a quick little story. I grew up in Greencastle, Indiana, as a young child. Our parents were building a new home, and it wasn't done on time, kind of like Mr. Blanding's. So we moved in with a landlady across the street who had a big two-story house, and we rented her upper floor while the house was being done. And I didn't know this. Of course, I was a young child until I got older, but turned out the lady's name was Dillinger.
Interesting. I'm trying to think who that could be.
She was his aunt. I don't know whether she was a married aunt or, was it her married name or, she was an unmarried aunt.
Now, it's Greencastle. Forgive my ignorance, but isn't that where DePaul is?
Yes, and in fact,
that was one of the Dillinger gang.
What reminded me of it was that there was a show on the PBS, and the leadoff bank was the Central National Bank in Greencastle, Indiana.
Yeah, that was they robbed it of homecoming weekend, a DePaul homecoming weekend in the fall of 1933.
Yeah, I didn't know this. Of course, I was a young child, but what I always wondered afterwards, of course, she had a... it would probably be described as a rooming house in today's, vernacular. And, whether he just knew the town or whether he had some support. Well, anyway, his aunt lived in that town.
Good to know. Thank you.
This was the fall of 54. So, anyway, just a coincidental story.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Sure.
We have a couple minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 is the number. Maybe I would just ask you to, as we're coming to the end here, to tell the story about the death of Dillinger, since that's probably one of the most famous, and if people know anything, they at least know about the lady in red and about how he was shot down in front of the Biograph theater in Chicago.
The first part of that story... is that she was, well, of course, we now know she was not the lady in red. She was the lady in an orange skirt, and it just looked red under the neon lights that night.
Mm.
Dillinger's death was a result of a betrayal by a woman named Anna Sage, who was not the comely young thing that was on his elbow that night. Rather, she was a dowdy old brothel owner who had operated in northern Indiana and Chicago for many years. She was had immigrated from Romania, and at the time that Dillinger, who was dating one of her girls, moved in with her in June 1934, taking over a spare bedroom, she was on the verge of being deported. And one day in the middle of July, she got a letter from the Immigration Service that said she was to be deported, and the very next day she called a policeman friend, who then called the FBI. And the end of Dillinger happened amazingly quickly. This policeman and Anna Sage approached Melvin Purvis and his supervisor, Sam Calley, on a Saturday night, July 21st, 1934, and said, we can hand you Dillinger on a plate. All we want is the reward, which I think at that point was something like $15,000. We'll tell you where he's going to be the next evening outside a theater. And that night, the next night, Melvin Purvis and one of his men sat outside that theater for 30 or 45 minutes waiting for them to show up, and finally Dillinger with Anna Sage and his girlfriend arrived, went into the theater. By the time Dillinger came out of the theater at 10:30, it was surrounded by FBI men and as well as some officers from the East Chicago Police Department who were helping out. The funny story there is that Melvin Purvis was standing outside the box office, and he was to be the one who would observe Dillinger exiting, and then he was going to give a signal to everyone else by lighting a cigar. Well, Dillinger came out. Purvis saw him. Purvis went to light the cigar, and none of his men reacted. It turned out later, according to the FBI files, almost there were too many people around Purvis, and none of the other agents saw the signal. Luckily, a pair of FBI agents who were standing just about 10 feet down the sidewalk saw Dillinger. They didn't see the signal. Both of these gentlemen, one was from Texas, one was from Oklahoma, both were from this new group of agents that had been brought in to essentially kill Dillinger. Dillinger passed between them. They stepped behind him. They were joined by another agent named Ed Hollis, who would actually later be killed by Babyface Nelson. Dillinger turned, looked into Hollis's face, and within a split second, all three of the agents drew their guns. Six bullets were fired. Four struck Dillinger. Three were glancing blows, but one entered the back of his head, exited out through his eye, and he fell into an alley dead.
What's interesting, at least in some of the comments that you report from some of these people, was a sort of a sense of fatalism that eventually they die. Did any of them really think that somehow they would manage to get away clean and manage to live out a normal life after what they had done?
That's fascinating. You should put your finger on that, David, because there was a real sense of fatalism that you get in all the comments reported by all of them, from Dillinger to Bonnie and Clyde. And it was something about the Depression that just seemed to have made people depressed. There was a sense that none of us are going to get out of this, especially among the criminals. They had their fantasies. Dillinger thought he could make for South America. Babyface Nelson thought he could make for Europe. And Alvin Karpus, who was always the most creative, thought he might try Australia. But Karpus was the only one who ultimately left the country, hiding in Cuba for a while. But he wasn't so smart that he didn't ultimately come back and get captured. But you really do see that fatalism, especially with Dillinger, especially with Pretty Boy Floyd. They thought they had only a matter of time, and they were going to have as much fun as they could before they ultimately got caught or killed.
Well, there's some great stories in the book, and for people who want to read more, you just got to go out and look for it. It's titled Public Enemies, America's Greatest Crime Wave and the Birth of the FBI, 1933-1934. It's published by Penguin, by our guest Brian Burrow, who is a special correspondent at Vanity Fair. And I just want to say again, thanks very much for spending some of your time with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a thrill.
And again, Barbara, at Barbara's Books, that's where Brian Burrow will be. He'll be doing a signing tonight at 7:30 in the evening. That's Barbara's Books. It's in Oak Park at 1100 Lake Street. The program today made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. That's it for us. Up next, though, is the Afternoon Magazine. We want you to stay tuned. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about the mutiny on the Bounty. Our guest will be writer Caroline Alexander. She's the author of the best-selling book, The Bounty, The True Story of the Mutiny.